The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Free Library. My name is Michelle Saracini, and I'm the assistant for the Author Events Program. Thank you all very much for coming tonight. Before we begin, I just have a couple of friendly reminders. First of all, please make sure that your cell phones are turned off. And second of all, please no flash photography inside of the auditorium. Simon Winchester is a fantastic storyteller. From Indonesia in the explosion of Krakatoa to a San Francisco abruptly shaken at the turn of the 20th century, Mr. Winchester, through warm and convivial prose, is gifted with the ability to draw the reader into a complex tale in an extraordinarily graceful way, according to Time magazine. His diverse subjects have included W.C. Minor, an inmate at an asylum for the criminally insane, who contributed over 10,000 entries to the Oxford English Dictionary, to William Smith, the father of modern geology, to the subject of his new book, The Man Who Loved China, Joseph Needham. Needham was a British biochemist at Cambridge whose fascination with China, an extensive study of its history, language, and culture, grew into a lifelong obsession that resulted in the seminal 24-volume Science and Civilization of China. Please join me in welcoming Simon Winchester.
Great. Thank you very much indeed. It's lovely to be back here again. I had to go on a rock and roll station this afternoon, and they asked me to do some rap, which I've never done in my life. I vaguely know what it is, but I said, ladies and gentlemen, pay attention. This is a story of Chinese invention. The first book I wrote was about W.C. Minor, but this one's entirely devoted to China. And they thought it was... I thought it wasn't bad for someone completely unschooled in this. I thought I'd tell you, first of all, how I got involved in this this project. It started about, I guess, about 15 years ago now, 1994. I was writing a book about the Yangtze River. And as some of you who may have been to the Yangtze will know, there's a stretch of about 300 miles of the river where it's squeezed between two mountain chains and flows with great ferocity and great speed. And it's very difficult for sailing vessels to get upstream against the rush of the current. And when I was writing the chapter relating to this, I figured I needed to know what a Ming Dynasty or a Qing Dynasty sailing junk looked like. It would have to be extremely light and extremely nimble, but very strong and very capacious to carry all the cargo. And so I asked a friend of mine who knew a thing or two about ships, and he said, well, there are two classic books, G.R.G. Worcester, The Junks and Sampans of the Yangtze, or Volume 4, Part 3 of Joseph Needham, Science and Civilization in China. Neither book, neither author had I ever heard of. But that was on a Friday, and the next day, a Saturday, I happened to be in Salisbury, Connecticut, where there was a wonderful but now defunct bookstore called Lion's Head Books, run by a wonderful but not defunct owner called Mike McCabe, who knew everything, one of these amazing bibliophiles who knew everything about every book ever written. And I marched in and I said, I've got two very obscure books that I want to get. Have you ever heard of Junks and Sampans of the Yangtze? And he said, oh, you mean G.R.G. Worcester? Yes, we normally have a copy in stock. And in fact, yes, here's one. And he plucked it down and sold it to me. And I said, well, Mike, you're amazing. I go for broke. Then have you ever heard of a book called Science and Civilization in China? And he looked at me as if I was a sort of insect. And he said, you do mean Joseph Needham? And I said, yes. He said, you've never heard of him? And I said, actually, no, I haven't. And he said, well, shame on you. The most important Englishman ever to have lived in China. The most extraordinary chap. And I think he said his entire oeuvre was of Science and Civilization in China was 24 volumes long. And he said occasionally, very occasionally, we get complete sets, but they're very, very expensive. I mean, thousands of dollars. But we often have a single volume in stock, and I think we've probably got one today. So he disappeared down into his basement like the White Rabbit and came up a few moments later and blew the dust off this, which, when he showed it to me, happened to be Volume 4, Part 3, by extraordinary coincidence. And this is absolutely true. There's his original price tag, Volume 4, Part 3, $75. So for $100, I had exactly the two books that I wanted. And I took them out to the car and sat looking at this particular book, which is, how many pages? It's 930 pages, all devoted to one subject, which is China's relationship with water. And so it was everything to do with the design of junks and sampans. So it had drawings of sails and rudders and masts, and it had exactly what I needed as far as sailing junks made for the Yangtze, the three gorges in the Ming and the Qing. But it also had lighthouses and the design of canals and lock gates and the compass, everything to do with water. And I read it enthralled, I must have stayed in the car for half an hour before heading for home, thinking to myself, who on earth was this man that wrote this book? Because this was just one of 24, and there were equally large volumes on botany and on medicine and on alchemy and astrology and engineering and every imaginable aspect of science and technology, mathematics, and all in this amazing series, essentially created by this one chap who I knew nothing about. And I thought, well, one day, perhaps, I'll write a book about him. So he was always at the back of my mind. And then a couple of years ago, I signed the contract with HarperCollins and began work on him. And he did turn out to be every bit as extraordinary a chap as you would imagine from the books he created. He was born in 1900 in London, English, to a father who was a very sort of ascetic, serious, sober-sided doctor, an anesthesiologist. And his mother, by contrast, and the two loathed each other from the get-go. And there were tremendous volcanic fights between them, which involved the throwing of all sorts of things, plates mainly. She was a singer. She was Irish and French. His second wife, actually. I think the first one died. And her one claim to fame is that she, when drunkards are arrested in England, staggering out of pubs singing, they're usually singing a song which is generally called the Drunkard's Lullaby, but whose proper name is Nellie Dean. It's not very well known in this country, but Nellie Dean was composed by Mrs. Needham. That's the only distinction she has, but it is nonetheless quite a distinction. The two of them, the parents of which the child was the only child, born in just before Christmas 1900, they disagreed about everything to do with his upbringing, including naming him. So they gave him four names. They called him Noel, Joseph, Terence, Montgomery, Needham. And his father insisted on calling him Noel because he was born near Christmas time, and his mother insisted on calling him Terence. And the young child decided that he would call himself Joseph in a spirit of sort of filial compromise. So it was an erratic and unusual childhood. He had a French maid brought over by his mother, and or at least a governess. And his father, nonetheless, was an extremely good and kind man, and he had a lot of friends in London who, well, he taught Joseph language, such to the point that when Joseph was 16, he already had a pretty fair command of, I think, seven languages. I mean, Greek and Latin and French and Spanish were sort of taken as the norm for a fairly well-educated middle-class child in London at the time. But he also had Russian and he had Polish as well. So he was pretty bright, and there was one of his father's friends was a surgeon who allowed young Joseph to come into the operating theatre to act as an assistant, and for every time he handed the surgeon catgut and things like that to sew up people, he was given a sovereign or something to assist. So he had a very keen interest in human physiology and anatomy. And when it was time to go up to university, he got into Cambridge. He assumed he'd become a surgeon, but he quickly dismissed that idea. He thought that surgeon, it was really rather a prosaic calling. Sawbones, I think, was the word that was used at the day. And one of his masters at school said that the future, my boy, lies in atoms and molecules, and insisted that he should learn chemistry of some sort. So he did. He took a degree in chemistry and then took a PhD, because he was clearly very bright, under a remarkable man, the founder, essentially, of the science of biochemistry, a man called Hopkins, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering vitamins, or vitamins, as they're called here. And so by 1924, this young man had proved himself to be so adept and so intellectually remarkable that he was given a full fellowship by his college, Caius College, Cambridge. And he was given rooms which he occupied for the next 70 years, for the rest of his life. Rooms which, oddly enough, today, room K1 in Caius, is occupied by, and it sort of shows the sort of continuum of intellectual life at Cambridge, is occupied by Stephen Hawking, the cosmologist. Needham was a somewhat eccentric fellow. He was very, very left-wing. I mean, he, for various childhood reasons, became interested in the working man. And, of course, 1917 was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And he became almost a communist. I mean, his social life was wrapped up very much with the ultra-left wing in Cambridge. But he was also a very keen Christian and remained so for the rest of his life. And so the dilemma, if I can call it that, of being at one sort of proto-Marxist and also a keen Christian was something that always sort of vexed him and caused him some sort of trouble. He was also very keen on gymnosophy, which some of you may know is the polite word for nudism. Nudism was seen by the left wing in Britain of the time as being a way for working people to show their equality. And once they took off their kit, they were all essentially the same. So he was a very keen nudist, and he was also a practitioner of this very unusual form of wild dancing called Morris dancing. I don't know if any of you know. It's a sort of pagan English dancing. So a picture is emerging of this very tall man, spectacles, tousled hair, looked a bit like an enormous version of Harry Potter, who danced naked, although I think he was a nudist who danced. I don't think he often or ever, in fact, danced naked. He also played the accordion very well. Someone said, well, mercifully, at least he didn't play the cymbals, which for a nude person could be very dangerous. And he was, I don't mean to be vulgar. And he was also very, very keen on women. He loved women. And the biochemistry department under Hopkins was full, as someone remarked, he said, of clever Jews and pretty young women. So there were, he mixed with a lot of Jewish people and a lot of young women. And he dated the young women ferociously. And eventually married one of them. And she was called Dorothy. And she was also a biochemist. She was interested in the mechanics of muscles. His particular interest was in the development of the egg. So he was an embryologist. And indeed, by the age of 25, had written a 3-volume work, a definitive work, still in print on embryology, chemical embryology it was called, which indicated that he had taken to heart one of the pieces of advice given by one of his schoolmasters, to think in oceans. Think big. Don't be sort of sucked down by the minor, the pettifogging, the little details. Think big. He was a big man for aphorisms. His father would post aphorisms all over the house. Never go upstairs empty-handed. It's actually something that I now practice at home. Whenever I see stairs, I look around for something to and actually it's a very good thing to do. Never have 3 helpings of anything. You catch more flies with honey than with vinegar. And principally, think in oceans and give things only a passing view. In other words, be very anti-materialist in your outlook. So, Dorothy, The expert on mussels clearly thought that this was a chap worth going out with, and eventually they married on Friday the 13th, I think 1925, it might have been 1926. But he declared to her on the eve of the wedding that he intended, if it was all right with her, to regard this as an open marriage. And this was Cambridge, left-wing, very sort of liberal attitudes, and so she said, fine, okay, if whatever makes you happy. Although I think from reading her diaries, she was always a little bit unhappy because she, I think, remained fairly true to the marriage. Joseph most certainly did not. And anyway, through the late 20s and early 30s, they settled into the routines of what I think would have been a fairly typical Cambridge intellectual, scientific, left-wing, Christian, dancing, nude, accordion-playing life, you know, just everyday people. But everything then changed in the autumn of 1937, because out of a clear blue sky, and indeed from the city, from Shanghai in China, came a young Chinese woman researcher to work to do a PhD at Cambridge under the tutelage of Dorothy Needham. And this young woman, who was called Lu Guizhen, was very clever, very diminutive, and quite beautiful. And Joseph, true to his leanings, immediately fell for her. And Dorothy, of course, was at least publicly complacent about it, and the three of them became friends. Well, you can chart the progress of the affair by looking at his university diary day by day by day. And you can see it becomes more intense, but you're not convinced that they actually did the evil deed until February, I think the 17th, 1938. And then there are a number of clues, but this is not just out of prurient interest. There's an important point to be made. It shows what happened on this date. Whenever Joseph made references to his wife in the diary, for some reason he wrote about her in Greek. So on this particular day, there's a reference in Greek, which I found extremely hard to translate, saying, sent Dorothy to Babbicum. I mean, the Greek for Babbicum, it's not a sort of word you expect to see in Greek, because Babbicum is a little village in Devon, where she had come from. Anyway, once having translated that, we realized that Dorothy had been sent to see her parents, and therefore leaving the coast clear in Cambridge. He then took Guizhen to a film, and the film was just had its premiere in Cambridge, a film that I'm sure many of you have seen, which is The Good Earth. And this, he thought, would make Guizhen both nostalgic and, he hoped, pliant. To make certain that she was pliant, he then took her to the Venetian, which was the most expensive Italian restaurant in the Cambridge of the time, liquored her up, I guess, and then took her back to the room that would ultimately become Stephen Hawking's room, K1 in Caius College. And after that in the diary, there are three large asterisks, which, to a person with a mind like mine, can only signify one thing, or perhaps one thing done three times. But anyway, clearly something happened. But it was what happened after that that's really the most important part of this story. Because for the first time ever in his life, you see him writing in his diary a Chinese character. And if any of you know what this is, then please don't shout it out. But to those of you that don't know, my question is, having dispatched your wife 200 miles away, taken your girlfriend to a movie, got her a little bit tipsy, taken her to the room, done whatever the asterisks signify, what Chinese character, under her tutelage, of course, would Joseph Needham write in his diary? Does anyone have any ideas?
Love.
Well, it's so nice. It's invariably women that say love. It's such a, I mean, so it should be. I mean, the three of you, love, it's so nice and charming. No. any other thoughts? Well, the Chinese euphemism for having sex is and it wasn't this either, is clouds and rain. So some people say clouds and rain, but it wasn't that either. But what it was, Actually, if you've seen Now Voyager, it will become clear it was cigarette. Yes, exactly. Both of them smoked like chimneys, and you can imagine after the evil deed was done, Joseph lit two of his favourite brand, which were Players, passed one to Gwei Jen, then took it out of his mouth and rolled the cylinder of tobacco between his fingers and said, "How do you write this in Chinese?" And she showed him, and when she showed him, so a door opened on a completely alien universe, and he fell almost instantly in love with the idea of learning Chinese, and through the learning of Chinese, learning about China. And he said, "I've got to learn your language." He said he entered the glittering crystalline world of the Chinese language. And within a year, thanks both to Gwei Jen and to the then professor of Chinese at Cambridge, a man called Gustav Halun, he had mastered and he made all these extraordinary little homemade dictionaries. He could both write and read with an enormous degree of precision Chinese, and he could speak in the Mandarin that's spoken in Nanjing, which is where Gwei Jen came from, pretty fairly too. In three more years, he could speak extremely well. But she was astonished by his speed of his ability. And so, by 1941, 42, he was a Chinese-speaking, left-wing, new, dancing biochemist. Well, consider the situation in China at the time. Ever since 1841, the China had been gnawed away by foreign powers, the British when we took Hong Kong in 41, the French, Hainan Island, the Germans, Shandong, the Russians, then the Japanese in Manchuria. And from 1937 onwards, the eastern half or the eastern third of China had been occupied by Japan. And one of the many things that happened in that occupation was that all the major universities of China had fled to the safety or the comparative safety of the West. It was rather like, you know, Harvard and Yale and Penn packing up all their students and faculty and their books and the laboratory equipment and other teaching aids and putting them on the back of donkeys and marching them for weeks, months at a time over the plains and over the mountains and putting themselves in the safety of Salt Lake City and Denver and Tucson and places like that. That's exactly what was happening in China. The universities, tremendous privation and long route marches for all these people, but they ended up in the western Chinese cities of Chongqing, now Chongqing, Changsha, Kunming, and places like that, where they were relatively free from attacks from the Japanese. And although officially the British and the Chinese the British and the American governments were neutral so far as the taking sides with the war between Japan and China, the British government was deeply concerned about the plight of Chinese universities and said that they made a policy decision that they must try and help Chinese intellectual life remain alive, even under these very straitened circumstances. And in particular, they realized that the Chinese universities needed scientific equipment and books and papers and reagents and test tubes and Bunsen burners and all the paraphernalia that scientists need. And so they looked around for a British scientist who spoke Chinese to head a mission to undertake this. And Joseph Needham was the obvious choice. And so all of a sudden, in 1942, the British government said, "Would you like to go to China? You'll have a very hard time. It's very difficult. But this will be your mission to bring succor and comfort to Chinese universities in free China." And so he got on a convoy ship and went off to Calcutta and then was given a pistol and got on an American plane and flew over the hump, this famous the route of the Flying Tigers, to Kunming, and arrived in the China of which he had dreamed ever since Gwei Jen taught him in February 1938 that first character, cigarette. Well, the story of what he then did in China and the adventures he had, I suppose, fills the bulk of the book that I've written. His first day in Kunming is sort of instructive about of the attitude he took. He was sitting there on a crisp early spring day, beautiful weather, the Himalayas in the distance, the uphills of Tibet in the distance anyway. And he was sitting, smoking, looking at the scenery around him, and he was watching a man graft an apple tree. And as he looked at him, he realized that the way the man was grafting the tree was significantly different from the way he remembered his father grafting a tree which stood in their back garden in London. So he started taking notes and making drawings and thought if he investigated the documents and papers, which of course he could now read, he might find out how old grafting was in China. Well, it turned out that the basic principles of grafting of fruit trees was all invented by the Chinese hundreds of years before Westerners did, and indeed, of course, the apple, as I'm sure you all know, comes from China in the first place. Everything that he saw in those early days, he looked carefully at the various inventions and devices and tried to think, are these older than the equivalents that I've seen in Britain? He had a robe made, for instance, and he was looking at the calculating engine, the abacus that the tailor was using, and realized quite swiftly, and had it confirmed when once again he looked at some archives and found early drawings, that the abacus as a calculating machine was of great antiquity, and indeed the concept of number, enormous antiquity. So he began to be seduced by the idea that Gui Zhen had put to him back in Cambridge, which is that it was unfair for the West to deride and dismiss China, which they did and had for many years, this booby nation. Your poet Emerson had dismissed China by calling it simply a booby nation that was of no value to anybody. It was just a country that gave the world, rhubarb, silk, tea, ceramics, and that was it. But Gui Zhen had said, no, there is a tremendous history of scientific and technological invention, and you should have an open mind when you go to China. So he did. And he started painstakingly amassing notes on what the Chinese had made and the significance of their inventiveness. But soon he had managed to prove, for instance, the famous Francis Bacon quote, that the three greatest inventions made in human history that most significantly changed civilization was printing, gunpowder, and the compass. And at the time Bacon made that remark, they had no idea where those three things came from. All of them, China. Printing is a good example. We had always thought, had we not, and I'd been taught at school, that it was Caxton and Gutenberg. But in fact, the Diamond Sutra, found in 1907 in Dunhuang in western China, 868 AD, 600 years older. And the same story goes for both of the other things, the compass, many hundreds of years before they started using it in the Mediterranean, and gunpowder, similarly. So he amassed this huge amount of knowledge about Chinese science and technology and decided when he got back to England at the end of the war that he would somehow try and encapsulate it in a book, both as a catalogue, an encyclopedia of their achievements, and also to try and grapple with a question that troubled him, which was if the Chinese had invented so much so early, everything from the stirrup to toilet paper. They invented toilet paper in the 11th century, which is obviously a very civilizing thing to do. Why had they then, in the 16th and 17th century, this inventive zeal had failed them and they had fallen into poverty and backwardness, and the energy, the Einsteins and the Galileos and the Keplers, the Newtons, were all Westerners? Why was big science all the province of the West and Chinese inventiveness just disappeared? That became known as the Needham question, and it's still debated to this day. So to answer these questions, or to help answer these questions, he decided to write a book and put to Cambridge University Press the idea that he should do such a thing in one volume. And then, rather like with the story of the Oxford English Dictionary, which was originally going to be four volumes and take 10 years to do, it grew and grew and grew. It became seven volumes, then 10. Then by the time he died in 1995, 17. And it's still being produced by the institute that bears his name, the Needham Institute in Cambridge. There are now 24 volumes, all similar size to this. And there are four more planned. So it's a magnificent monument to the achievements of the Chinese people, and a document which in a huge way has served to change the Western view of China, that respect should now be given to a people who a century ago, less than a century ago, were dismissed as being essentially beyond the pale of human civilization. I want, in conclusion, without going into great detail, although maybe we can during questions, just to offer you three short sort of codas to the story, You may wonder what happened to Dorothy and Gwei Jen. Well, they remained together, the three of them. 1987, Dorothy died, aged 92, whereupon Joseph married Gwei Jen, who had been waiting in the wings for 51 years. She then died 2 years later, where, you know, even though he was only 90, or was 90 rather, he then proposed to three more women. Not at the same time, it has to be said, but wisely, they all turned him down, and he died. He died in 1995. There's an episode of his life which I go into in some detail where politically he was extremely naive and he made a very big blunder in 1953 which resulted in his being banned from the United States. The State Department, and obviously in the 1950s this was largely because of McCarthy and he was a near communist, the ban remained in place from 1953 until 1978. And by 1978, many of these volumes had come out. He was a fellow of the Royal Society. He was the master of his college at Cambridge. He was a man of huge international distinction. And yet, whenever he was asked to come and lecture at Harvard or Berkeley or wherever, the State Department said no, until 1978, when the University of Chicago offered him an honorary degree, and the State Department said, okay, you can come in now. So he came in, went to Chicago and gave three lectures. And the second of these three lectures was delivered on the subject of Chinese gunpowder and early Chinese weapons and bombs. One member of the audience that day, Ted Kaczynski, who 6 weeks later, using a design displayed as a slide by Needham in his lecture, created his first ever bomb, which exploded, injuring a security guard, and after two or three more attempts, earned him the name of the Unabomber. So one might argue that if the State Department ban had continued, there would have been no Unabomber. Ted Kaczynski would have done other things. And the final thing, I want to make 2 points from this last little story, which I'll try not, I'm looking at the time, try not to linger over. Joseph Needham is extremely well known in China, not very well known here, but with his Chinese name, Li Yusi, very well known indeed. A Chinese delivery man came to the door of our apartment, which we then had in Washington, D.C., a couple of years ago, and I didn't have any money. So he said, oh my God, let's go down to the ATM in the street below. So this small Chinese man put the two plastic bags on the kitchen table, and my wife started laying the table. And I went to the lift with the delivery man and pressed the button, and it wouldn't come. So, you know, one has to make conversation with this chap, and so I said, where are you from? And he said, Shanghai, and we exchanged a few pleasantries, and then conversation lapsed a bit. And then I thought, I'm just writing a book about Joseph Needham, I said to him, and he looked blank and as uninterested as you imagine a delivery man would look. But then I said, Li Yusi, and he said, you're writing a book about Li Yusi? I said, do you know him? He said, of course I know him, and every educated Chinese person knows who Li Yusi is. He's the most wonderful Englishman ever to have lived in China. You're writing, I said, yes, my God, this is, I said, I'm back in the apartment, I've got letters, photographs, all sorts of things. Would you like to see them? And yes, I would. So he came back, my wife, somewhat perplexed, and I, you know, instead of eating, I turn up with the delivery guy again. And so I showed him these pictures and things, and he was, I thought, lapping it all up. My wife then said, I think actually he would like to have his money, you know, he's just being polite. And I said, yes, of course, you're right. So we went out again, and we went down to the street, and I got him his money, and I said goodnight to him. So I walked back to the apartment, and I heard footsteps behind me. And I looked round, and it was the delivery man, and he had obviously parked his bike sort of near me, so near the entrance to the flat. So although the conversation was formally at an end, I thought it impolite not to carry on chatting. So I said, when you lived in Shanghai, what was your job? And he said, I worked in the computer department of the Standard Chartered Bank. Well, because I knew one very small fact about Standard Chartered in Shanghai, that it used to be called Macaulay's Bank, or and is known colloquially as Macaulay Bank, I said, oh, Macaulay Bank. And he stopped in the middle of Columbia Road, cocked his head to one side and looked at me and said, Simon? And I said, Gordon? It turns out that 20 years before, I'd made a film about him for the BBC. More than that, we stood there hugging one another. I had filmed him in 1987. We were doing a series of 10 films on the last 10 years of British Hong Kong and seeing how the lives of a banking chap in Hong Kong and a banking person in China would converge during those 10 years. So we filmed him in 87. We filmed him again in 88, brought him to Hong Kong, actually got him a visa and brought him to Hong Kong. And in 89, I had sponsored his visa application to come to this country and had paid his first semester to do a PhD here at Drexel University. He completely disappeared until 20 years later, there he is delivering Chinese food in Washington, D.C. And of course, and this is the final coda to it all, because it displays how everything has changed in the world in the last few years. I said, he took us out to, I took him back to the apartment, my wife now tearing her hair out, what's going on, this relationship with the delivery man? But a few days later, he and his wife, who I also knew from filming, took us out to dinner and explained. He had got his PhD here. He had taken advantage of a Canadian citizenship plan and got Canadian citizenship and worked for General Motors of Canada in Toronto. Then was offered a job back in America by the Raytheon Corporation, came and took that job. But on the day after 9/11, all non-Americans were fired. But he had Microsoft and Oracle qualifications, and so he set himself up as a consultant and was doing very well, and is doing very well, but has decided that all he wants to do now is to go back to the country of the future, which is China. In 1987, 88, 89, America was the goal of his life, the center of the world, the center of his dreams. Now everything's changed. In America, he says he's just another Chinese guy. He's anonymous. If he goes back to China with money, with an American degree, with the English language, he can have standing. So his whole goal is to go back to China, and now he's headlong earning as much money as he possibly can. So he works all day till 6 o'clock as a consultant, picks up his wife, has dinner, and at 7:30, comes and parks outside Mr. Chen's organic food restaurant on Connecticut Avenue, reading technical manuals for the following day. And every half hour, Mr. Chen comes out with two plastic bags and says, deliver those to 1851 Columbia Road. And he figures it's another $5 in tips, which I can add to the great fund I'm amassing, because China is the center of my dreams. And that, Joseph Needham predicted and would entirely have approved of, because I saw a sign in China when I was last there outside a space center on the borders with Turkestan in the west, which said quite starkly in English, without haste, without fear, we will conquer the world. And I think this man, Gordon Choi, Choi Guohong, the delivery guy, he believed that. And I think also Joseph Needham knew inevitably it would happen also. So thanks very much. So if I can answer any questions, I'd be delighted to try. The gentleman there in the middle. I beg your pardon. This is so rude. I have terrible eyes. I really do. And a jolly attractive one, too. Would you give this lady a microphone? There we are. It's coming to you. What a terrible mistake.
No, that's okay. I have bad eyes as well. We read, right?
I'm wearing a pretty frock today.
I've read your book, Up the Yangtze, and so...
Can I just stop you for a moment? There is a film called Up the Yangtze, which has just been issued, and it's a wonderful film about the dam. My book is called The River at the Center of the World, but I do urge you to go and see Up the Yangtze.
Well, it was your book, but I couldn't remember the title. I apologize for that. So we're even.
Great. Terrific.
It was wonderfully written, and I actually read it before I went to China. So I want to know if you had been back to China since writing that book, because it was really memoir, your own personal experiences, any changes you've seen over time?
Yes, I mean, I have, and many times. And to go back for this book specifically, because Needham made 11 journeys through China in the 1940s and then went back a lot of times until he became essentially too old to in the late 1980s. So I've followed in his footsteps on four of the biggest of the journeys. And maybe I can give you one example of how it's changed. I was on the road to Dunhuang, which is in western China, and we were on a very lonely stretch of road in about 250 miles this side, I mean the east side of Dunhuang. And you've got the Gobi Desert on the right and a range of mountains on the south and nothing, just nothing. It was about 9 o'clock in the evening and it was very cold, and suddenly, awful bang, the bottom of the car hits a rock. And I get out of the car and I see all the oil draining out of the sump. So I had chewing gum, I chewed up a big wad of it, plugged the hole as best I could, which is what one is told to do in these circumstances. So always travel with chewing gum and a squash ball. Squash ball is when you don't have a plug in the sink. Very good thing to carry with you. We went on for about another 5 miles, and then there was a horrible thud, and the plug of chewing gum came out on the sand, and all the remaining oil drained out. So the car is now, and it's now dark. No oil, no nothing. And we were, well, I can think of many words, but in a tight spot. What I didn't realize was that the Chinese, even in this really remote part of China, today's China, have been very forward-thinking. And even in the Gobi Desert, there's a chain of cell phone towers. But more than that, I had my BlackBerry. And I sat in the car thinking, what on earth to do? And I wonder if I can get any cell phone signal. So I switched it on. The little thing came up, showing not only GPS, or whatever it's called, signal, but GPRS, which is a data signal. It seemed to be quite strong. Goodness knows where it was coming from. But I thought, my God, I can probably get on the internet. So, yes, Google. And I Googled hotels Dunhuang, China. Sure enough, a list of hotels came up. I clicked on one, got its telephone number, called. And I said, in English, and a woman called Mary, a wonderful name considering the circumstances, answered. And I said, I'm in a broken-down car about 400 kilometers east of you. And I don't know what to do. And she said, do nothing. Put your flashers on. We'll send out a car from here, and it'll be with you in about 5 hours. So go to sleep, and you'll be all right. 5 hours later, two sets of headlights turn up on this lonesome road. No other traffic in that entire 5 hours. One was a crane to take the car away, and another was a Land Cruiser with two guys with noodles and beer. And I thought, this is the new China. And it would never happen, you know, even with one star. I don't think you'd get as good service as that. Certainly you wouldn't get noodles anyway. So it's changed, and I've been back a lot, yes. Sir, and you are a man, I think.
I want to confirm what I've heard you say. I'm part of a group called Teach for Friendship. It's headquartered in Tucson, Arizona. It's about 80 to 100 people who teach conversational English at Huazhong University of Science and Technology in Wuhan every year. It's the top graduate students, some of the top graduate students in China, but 80 to 100 people go over every year. My wife and I have taught there three Septembers for 3 or 4 weeks each time. And the first time we went over was in 2004. And at that point, the students were very restless against the Bush administration. And they said, what are you dealing with? Why did you reelect them? You know, all this kind of stuff. The next year we went over, we said, what do you think? We're not a political group, not a religious group. We're just promoting peace. That's all we do. We don't get into politics or anything. And we said, what do you think about the United States? Well, last year, we were against the Bush administration. Now, we don't even need you.
Yeah, that's very, very instructive. I mean, the old Napoleonic warning, you know, China is like a sleeping dog. Do not wake her, for if you do, when she does, the whole world will tremble. That I was asked the other day to write a piece for Parade magazine, which I had never read. But it has a circulation of 70 million copies each weekend. Basically to say, yes, China's had a bad press. And there's all the trouble about Tibet and the lead and the recalls and the corruption. But we've got to learn to understand these people. I mean, I don't have to learn that. I love China. I mean, I'm another man who loved China, and evidently you are so too. But I think many people do not, or many people are afraid or suspicious. And I think they're the nicest people, and they mean well. And I know in terms of government politics and policies, they need, and they know they need to change all these various problems. And I think they will. They're not fools. They're certainly not fools. And I think we need to get ourselves into a situation where we do not fear trembling, as Napoleon predicted, but engage with the people that are very keen now to engage with us. I think China policy, if Obama gets in, I assume it's one of the things that we're thinking of. Constructive engagement with China is very, very important. So.
Yes. Hi, how are you? You left us hanging when you said that in about the 1600s, suddenly the inventions came to the West. Was there something that actually changed in China, or was that more a function of publicity?
Well, it's a very complicated question. It's still being debated to this day why things... It's not so much why they ended in China, but why there was a sudden beginning of ferment at the time of the Renaissance in Europe that led to scientific advances being essentially modern science as opposed to older science being a Western thing. There are many schools of thought. The one that appeals to me most is, going back to China for a second, that it remained for a very long time the summit of every educated Chinese person's ambition was not to become a merchant or a scientist or an engineer, was to become a bureaucrat, to join the Mandarinate, to take the Confucian examinations, which had been the same examinations for hundreds and hundreds of years, learning the Chinese classics, making sure that Chinese society represented, despite the passing of time, a seamless continuum where China was exactly the same and run in exactly the same way, was hugely important. Europe, of course, and it was essentially one country too, whereas Europe was a set of competing nations. And if, for instance, to move it to the 16th century, if the Spaniards in Toledo made a blade of steel and happened to be at the time at war with the Portuguese or the Italians or the French or the Dutch or whoever, their technologists would put all their energy into making a better sword or better oil or better cannons or whatever. And so there would be this spur of competition which made for technological advances, which the Chinese didn't have, not least because they were one country, but also because this wasn't in their great sort of canon of, to use the other sense of the word canon, of ambition. There are many other reasons, but currently the thinking is, and this goes back to that sort of apocryphal story, almost certainly apocryphal, which represents the Chinese long view of history. When Zhou Enlai was asked, what did you think of the French Revolution? And he said, I think it's too early to tell. Similarly, with China so obviously bouncing back today, and with your university in Wuhan presumably being a place of great intellectual ferment and invention now, you can look at this period when there wasn't much going on in China, from, let's say, 1600 to 2000 or 1990, and say that in the broad sweep of Chinese history, it was merely a bad period. It was a hiccup, if you like, which, you know, is a hiccup that can be investigated by academics, but actually has not particularly great significance in the history of China as a whole. But the Needham question is still a matter of considerable debate, but in a way has become moot. Sir, I beg your pardon. How about you, sir? Yes, sir. Oh, I'm so sorry. Well, anyway, yes. You next. Right, sir.
If this is really to be the Chinese century, which has been predicted, don't you think that they're going to really have to step up technology and science to do that? It's hard to visualize this being the Chinese century without them being very strong in this area.
I absolutely agree with you, but then so does the State Council, and I think a huge amount of money is being poured into precisely those fields at Chinese universities now. That's one of the reasons, of course, there are such a lot of Chinese students here, and why so many people like Gordon Choi are going back to China now so that they can do precisely as you say. No, I think it's a matter of state policy that ramp up the science that has been so moribund for so long. I think we'll start seeing a very different approach to science and technology from, let's say, the Japanese, who are perfecting, in many cases, existing technology. I think we'll see new science, new developments coming out of Chinese laboratories. I absolutely anticipate that. Sir, behind.
It strikes me that Needham is particularly fascinating insofar as he spans the gamut of interest, both in the sciences and the humanities, you might say. I have a rather twofold question. One is, to what extent, could you talk a little about the intellectual ferment that he might have benefited from at Cambridge in the 20s and 30s? Was he particularly close to any of the Cambridge apostles, things of that sort? And how did that influence his thought, if at all, in your judgment? Secondly, who are some of the folks that you might have encountered who were helpful for you in putting Needham in perspective? Obviously, there's a wonderful intellectual biographer, Lord Noel Annan, who's done wonderful work. David Cannadine has written on Jim Trevelyan and others. And I was wondering how you've seen, if at all, any kind of evolving historical perspective.
It was a very interesting question. The person that is wanting to write the intellectual biography of Needham, and I hasten to say that, A, I'm not an intellectual nor a biographer, really, but my interest is to write the human story of this remarkable man. But his longtime assistant was a man called Gregory Blue. And Greg Blue is at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. And he has for a long time been planning to write Needham's intellectual biography. But he's very ill, and it seems likely that that will be delayed. So I think, there is a market for this book to be written. In answer to your question about who were the people that he was surrounding himself with in the Cambridge, well, I list a lot of them in towards the end of the book when he was, for instance, after this mistake he made in the 1950s, and basically that was all to do with his accusation that the Americans had used biological weapons during the Korean War. That's why he was banned from coming here. He sought solace in the company of a number of scientists, particularly in those days. But he was friendly with a number of the apostles and the people who later went on to be spies. He taught Philby, for example. But nonetheless, even though there is a suspicion that he might have been used occasionally by the intelligence agencies, so far as China was concerned, it was not so dangerous as selling state secrets to the Russians. Obviously, that was a criminal offense. But he never went overboard, so far as we know, spying for either side. But his friends were a huge array of people, mostly left-wingers. I list them all. And he was also tremendously tolerant. For instance, one person who he was very close to in China was this remarkable, and here's a wonderful subject for a biography, a New Zealander called Rui Ali, who he met in Shuangshipu, which is up in west of Xi'an. Rui Ali, derided as the most famous New Zealander ever to have lived in China, was a homosexual. Needham supremely tolerant of all of his life, and eulogized Tom Dreiberg, for instance, who was another big influence of his when he, a very flamboyantly homosexual member of the Labour Party and MP. Rui Ali is a fascinating man. He invented this whole concept of the cooperative movement in China, where, because the Japanese had bombed all the factories in the East, so the production of everything from saucepans to bicycle wheels to, well, you name it, toothbrushes, was moved away from the big cities into tiny 5-man, 10-man, 15-man factories scattered, and there were thousands of them all over the rural hinterland of China. And oddly enough, the motto of what was known as the CIC, the China Industrial Cooperatives, invented by Rui Ali, was Gung He, which is ourselves together, which has become Gung Ho. So whenever you hear the phrase Gung Ho and you wonder at its etymology, it all came from this strange New Zealander, Rui Ali, a great friend of Needham's in China. So, spectacles. Sorry, I'll try and...
I'd like to follow up with the Vancouver, Victoria-Vancouver connection and his politics. I was in Seattle at the University of Washington in the late 70s, and the first time he came to the United States was actually, he gave a colloquium at the UW, where he had been in Vancouver, and it was right after they let him start coming.
So was it after 78 then?
It must have been. I was trying to remember because I was in school there 76 or 78. So
right.
It was probably,
well, probably
in spring of 78.
Right.
So, well, actually, he was in Vancouver and they had just released him. So he actually
dropped down into
Seattle. So what I was wondering was, did he come back very often? Because I didn't realize he had gone to Chicago. Was he interested in coming here, or did people invite him much after
Oh,
that?
Yes. I mean, he went on to receive lots more honorary degrees. So he did, and he was always keen on raising money to house his huge collection of books and papers, from which, of course, he derived most of his information. And in the end, John, I don't quite know how to pronounce his name, but either Diebold or Diebold, and that's not the inventor of the... voting machines, thank heavens, otherwise that money would have evaporated pretty quickly. But no, this was a computer science chap. He gave money, and also the Mellon Foundation. So Mellon is still a big supporter. So he did come here for many reasons for a very long time. And Gui Zhen taught here, and Dorothy would lecture here. Gui Zhen, in fact, when Needham went to China for the first time, Gui Zhen had gone to Berkeley, but got a terrible and nearly lethal allergy to acacia flowers, apparently, then took a job in Birmingham, Alabama, and then ended up at Columbia teaching, which for a young Chinese woman in the 1940s was somewhat unusual. And when Needham finally summoned her to come and join him in China, she was living on Haven Avenue in northern Manhattan, way up. I went to see her, the place where she lived, and... it's all part of Columbia University Medical School today. Over there, sir.
I just have a question about your composition methods or your working methods. You describe yourself, and I read the book about the Oxford Dictionary, not as a historian, but as someone who crafts human interest stories out of historical fact. And I wonder at what point a story develops as you begin to, when you go through a mass of factual material. For example, how do you arrive at a particular detail like the cigarette and say, oh, this is something that's going to be interesting in the story? I just wonder.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I did surround this with all sorts of caveats. I don't say this is what happened, because Joseph isn't obviously going to say, yeah, I went to bed with her and then I... It's just, it's knowing they smoked, surmising that they had sex, knowing what often happens after sex, and seeing the character for cigarettes or cigarette, I was tempted to say this is probably what happened. But in that particular page, this is not Jason Blair here, or Daniel Fry, despite the fact that he is being published by HarperCollins later this year. So I'm careful when it's speculative like that to make sure, A, it's reasonable speculation, and also that it's fair and surrounded with caveats and let-outs, as it were. But otherwise, it's just there's an enormous amount of material. The difficult thing in the case of Needham was getting permission from the keepers of the flame, because they're all Sinologists, and I'm not a Sinologist. I mean, Greg Blue in Victoria is very much, he's devoted his entire life to studying China, whereas to me, although I'm enormously fond of China, I have no Sinological credentials. I mean, you wouldn't say that my book on the Yangtze was a true credential. I'm sure true Sinologists would dismiss it as trivial. So I had to go to the Needham Institute, to a very lofty gathering of eminences, and say, look, the founder of your institute, the man who you all revere, is an extraordinary human being, and I think his story needs to be told to the world, and the way I tell stories, I can only show you the story of W.C. Minor and James Murray and William Smith, and hope that you think they're reasonably well told. And mercifully, there didn't seem to be too much muttering and say, oh, no, we can't have this chap writing them. And so they let me in. But once the papers, they're extraordinary. And the collection of all his stuff, he never threw anything away. And he collected all sorts of things, postcards, railway timetables, which I adore, railway train timetables, matchboxes. I mean, he was such an obsessive person, and yet you can tell so much about him from simply his artifacts as well as his papers. I hope that answers your question. There was a lady there, I think.
You answered my question. I really wanted you to ask you what your sources were for the story that you've created.
Right. Well, the main source is either the Needham archives at the University of Cambridge Library, Dorothy's papers, which are kept at Girton College, Cambridge, the papers relating to the Korean War incident, which are in the Imperial War Museum in London, or the papers and the artifacts, which are kept at the Needham Institute. There are a few other papers elsewhere, and of course there are lots of papers relating. For instance, the Kaczynski thing is from the FBI files. The whole question of his being banned, that was a very difficult thing to research, because the State Department and CIA files, they're very limited, very not forthcoming at all. And I had to file a Freedom of Information Act request, and I got very little, and an awful lot of it was redacted, and a lot of it was denied to me. And in the end, I thought, well, I've got the bare bones of the story, but there's more of a story to be told, I think, not least of which is, did the Americans use biological weapons? And that still hasn't been satisfactorily answered. Ah, one more. Sorry, I thought you were asking a question. We have time for one more, sir. She and I do keep in correspondence, and we see each other frequently. We last saw each other, we did a thing together on the QM2, the Queen Mary 2. And I must tell you, do I have time to tell me? She told me a wonderful story about the Queen Mary, that you've seen this great vulgar sort of floating Las Vegas. Well, maybe some of you are planning to go on holiday, in which case it's a wonderful ship, but not as elegant. Not as elegant as the one I could see from my hotel room in your harbour, which is, I think, the United States, isn't it? Well, how did the Queen Mary get its name? Do you know? I think it's a rather charming story. All the Cunard liners of old were named with names that ended in IA, Mauritania, Lusitania, Caronia. And they were going to, in the 1930s, they had laid down the keel for a vessel that they were going to call the Queen Victoria. And one day in about 1935, when the ship was nearly finished, the chairman of Cunard invited King George V to inspect the yards. And His Majesty was looking around at all the ships they were building and came to this massive hull and said, what are you planning to call this? And the chairman of Cunard said, ah, Your Majesty, I'm glad you asked. We're planning to call this after the greatest queen that ever lived. And the king said, my wife will be so pleased. And one coda. I've been asked to mention this, and this is a vulgar, nothing to do with that story at all, but I'd completely forgotten this. But on the same day as the book about Needham was published, also a book which I had forgotten writing was published as well. It's a children's version of Krakatoa. And so I was told, someone rang up and said, please mention it. So consider it mentioned. I think it's out there today. It's called The Day the World Exploded. It's out there, is it? Anyway, vulgar, don't buy it, ignore it, but I've done my bit. So thank you very much indeed.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.